Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 17, 2018. This is the week 6 class of our 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So we're on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path this week. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. The Buddha taught meditation for one primary purpose, and that is to deepen concentration. So from a less distracted quality of mind, we're able to develop right view. And we saw the last few weeks how right view and right intention both begins the a Dhamma practice, has us heading in the right direction, and it also helps us maintain a Dhamma practice. And we learn the importance of recognizing behavior as a way of recognizing eye-making in the moment. And when we recognize that we're acting in unskillful ways due to a misunderstanding of the three marks of existence, we simply abandon it. We don't mess around with it. We don't analyze it. We don't place any more importance over any singular and temporary aspect of any phenomena. Because if we do that, we're just going to get lost in the details of it. It's another useful strategy to ignore our own ignorance. This week, we're studying the Eightfold Path and those factors that directly relate to developing concentration. But notice in the Buddha's description here, this isn't to be done outside of the framework of the entire Eightfold Path. Right? The Buddha's words on right effort as right effort relates to the Eightfold Path. One efforts to abandon wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong mindfulness, and wrong meditation. Makes sense. If that's the path that the Buddha's teaching, we should abandon those aspects of the path that are holding us back from full awakening.
Can I ask, what are you reading from that? Is that your book?
Yes. And then the Buddha continues, and while efforting to abandon the unskillful aspects of the Eightfold Path, we also engage in effort to develop right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Again, makes sense, doesn't it? And you hear me repeating this often. It's the Eightfold Path, it's the Eightfold Path. It's not just meditation. There's other things that we need to consider. I learned that from the Buddha, because he found a need to say it often. And he's talking to experienced monks and nuns here. But he's, again, reiterating the importance of being mindful. This is the overarching way that the Buddha taught mindfulness, to be mindful of the Eightfold Path. So it's not so important that we're mindful of washing the dishes or driving a car or whatever else we might be doing. That is important. But we shouldn't overemphasize that and think that simply because I'm noticing that I'm washing the dishes that I'm practicing Buddhism. It's two different things. Being mindful of the Eightfold Path in relation to what I'm doing, including washing the dishes, is of paramount importance. But we can easily get lost in that wrong application of mindfulness that the Buddha's speaking of here. He concludes that by saying this is one's right effort. Then he goes a little bit further. Abandon what is unskillful in relation to the Eightfold Path. Abandon what is unskillful in relation to the origination and the continuation of dukkha, craving and clinging. Right? And again, this relates back to what we talked about in right intention and right view, too. Holding the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging is right intention, and it's also an aspect of right mindfulness and right effort, actually doing that. And it's remarkable when we go around the room how often that's really what we're describing, is the instances in our life when we're practicing the Dhamma and we recognize it. It's so important. And we've all been doing that these last few weeks. Excuse me. Abandon what is unskillful, meaning craving and clinging, and develop what is skillful, the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, if it were not possible to abandon what is unskillful and develop what is skillful, I would not teach this. It's one of the most important lines the Buddha ever taught. I wouldn't waste my time doing this if you people, meaning the people he's talking to, ordinary human beings, didn't have the ability to awaken. And upon his awakening, he thought seriously if it was possible to teach this in a way that could overcome people's tendency to ignore their own ignorance, a conditioned mind. And that's when he developed and understood the importance of an Eightfold Path. He didn't just say, you know, you guys thinking it's all wrong, go and meditate and you're good to go. In fact, he taught meditation as just one factor of the Eightfold Path. And he never emphasized it. He never overemphasized it. Meditation is important, and we can't develop the Eightfold Path without a right meditation practice. But we cannot completely develop the Eightfold Path without developing each factor in a mindful way. Is that clear? Another thing that's interesting, this is the fifth or sixth time that as a Sangha we've gone through this, how that last understanding has become much more important, that it really is the Eightfold Path, and it's through developing the Eightfold Path that we awaken. It's not through doing something else. It's not by finding something that we feel is more interesting and adding it to our Dhamma practice. Happens often. There was a push to do that right during the Buddha's lifetime, and this group succeeded within 200 years of the Buddha's passing, of changing his teaching dramatically because they wanted it to be different. Still calling it Buddhism, though. The Buddha emphasizes the Eightfold Path, and I emphasize it and re-emphasize it because it is the framework for our Dhamma practice. If we fall outside of that, as the Buddha just described, we could be putting a lot of effort into so-called spiritual practice and maybe even something that we want to call Buddhism, when in effect it's just a distraction, or at least at the very best, it's an addition. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do other things. In fact, Matt is teaching his Qigong class. This is a third Saturday. Every third Saturday he teaches a Qigong class. I would encourage every one of you to take the class because it's such a useful and skillful addition, physically and philosophically, to what we're doing here. But we should also be clear that it's not what the Buddha taught. Again, it doesn't mean we shouldn't engage in it, but we should understand what Dhamma practice is and what it isn't. And that way, we can directly address the most common problem and the most common hindrance is ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So if the problem is ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the solution would be developing in a direct and experiential way understanding of Four Noble Truths. We do that by integrating the Eightfold Path. The Buddha concludes this instruction by saying, be mindful of wrong effort and enter and remain in right effort. And he says that for the other two factors. He says it about each factor of the Eightfold Path. The proper application of mindfulness is to deepen concentration through Shamatha Vipassana meditation so that we can support the refined mindfulness of the entire Eightfold Path as a framework for our Dhamma practice. Is that clear? So they're not just words that we should consider every now and then. Over time, we will be able to live our lives within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And when we're finally able to do that, there's such meaning and purpose in life that wasn't there before, because we're meaningfully present for our life as life occurs. Excuse me. And I'm not describing an awakened human being or a fully mature human being. I'm simply describing levels of concentration and levels of mindful achievement along the way. And it's important to recognize that. When we're noticing behavior that in the past we would probably engage in out of a conditioned mind habitually, and now we're mindful, we're able to practice restraint, where once we might be lying or gossiping or just engaging in idle chatter or something else that falls out of the framework of right speech, right action, right livelihood, now we're able to mindfully restrain ourselves. That's the Dhamma practice. It's not just not having to restrain ourselves. Until we awaken, until we develop full human maturity, most of Dhamma practice is recognizing when we're outside of the framework of the Eightfold Path, at least in our thoughtful intention, so that we can restrain ourselves and maintain the framework of the Eightfold Path. And guess what happens? Out of that habitual retraining of the way we are acting by noticing it and practicing restraint, we're also repatterning the way we think. And it really works that way. That's one of the reasons why the Buddha didn't just put up a sign that described right behavior and said, memorize that and I'll see you in 45 years. He continually came back to that behavior sign, how we should behave and why we should be mindful of it. Not for typical moral or ethical values, not because if we engage in unskillful thought, word, or deed, we're going to burn in hell for X number of years. He didn't even address the problem. He didn't say it's not going to happen either. It's of no consequence to awakening. What's most important is to be mindful of the results and the consequences of our behavior right here, right now, as our life unfolds. And not as a consequence of, I've done something and now I have to pay for it from an outside agency. It's to recognize that the key to awakening is to be willing to completely face our behavior moment by moment as our life unfolds. That's another way of saying developing a non-distracted mind, a mind resting in samadhi, because that's why we do it. A mind that is conditioned towards distraction will continue towards distraction because that's its only strategy to ignore its own ignorance. And so when we finally gain the ability to recognize and abandon our behavior rooted in ignorance, then it simply falls away. It sounds almost too mundane, doesn't it, to be of value? But until you think about the consequences of the ongoing preoccupation with dukkha, with stress, the Buddha recognized that as the big problem. It's the problem that results from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So he taught an eightfold path to develop that profound understanding of suffering and what we contribute to it. Any questions so far? I just want to touch on...
Yeah, I have a question.
Please.
Behavior rooted in ignorance. So is our thoughts in that... are they in the umbrella of behavior?
Yes.
Yeah.
In another way of saying what I'm saying, in thought, word, and deed. And it ultimately is our thoughts, our thinking that we clean up. The importance of recognizing behavior is it's just that. Our behavior is yeah, it's following almost habitually but conditionally, based on the conditions that we're holding in mind, our actions are following that. In other words, it'd be impossible for me to ever tell a lie if I wasn't stuck in some form of self-referential views. There'd be nothing to even form that lie. Or to gossip, or to engage in idle chatter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is rooted in a lack of understanding of who we are in relation to the world we're in. Gaining insight into the three marks of existence, which is what we're leading into now in next week's study, is on anicca, anatta, and dukkha. So now we've developed an understanding of how to, somebody brought up the word samsara, how to escape samsara is wandering around endlessly in dukkha, in ignorance. How do we get out of it? It's through the Eightfold Path. And how long does it take? A couple minutes to a couple weeks, maybe a little longer. But it's doable. As the Buddha said, if this was not possible, I wouldn't teach it. And think about that from the point of view of an awakened human being. If this awakened human being knew that he was just teaching you to be rats in a maze, I thought about that. He knew that there was really no way of awakening, but he taught it anyway. He said, go do these kind of things. And it would be the ultimate cruelty, wouldn't it? To convince someone that you had a way to alleviate their pain and suffering once and for all, convince them when you know you don't. And of course, the Buddha didn't do that. That's why he continued to come back to an Eightfold Path. He continued to avoid the push, even during his time, to embellish it and make it something more than it is. Because he knew that this simple and direct path was a path that any human being could engage in and awaken. It's rooted in concentration, it's framed by the Eightfold Path, but it's possible. The Buddha addresses, this is from the Samadhi Sutta, the Buddha addresses those gathered. Friends, there are four qualities that are developed from concentration. Concentration, when developed in practice, leads to developing peace and calm here and now. If the Buddha's starting out with that, the importance of concentration, it's pretty important, isn't it? And what does it directly lead to? A calm and peaceful mind. How does the Buddha describe a calm and peaceful mind from the point of view of an awakened human being? that mind is calm and at peace. Again, to some that would sound even too mundane. Is that I'm going to put all my efforts into developing a calm and peaceful mind? I've noticed that a couple of shots of whiskey do the same thing. Why don't I just do that? It's easier. Or marijuana, or shopping, or TV, or Facebook, anything. Pick one. Or pick 10. Whatever we find that will distract ourselves from facing the reality that we don't understand what's going on, to initiate the beginnings of right view by just accepting the fact that there's another way of looking at the world, then I can change everything. But I have to accept myself right where I am in order to begin this. And a self-referential ego self never wants to admit that it was wrong about anything, especially something as fundamental as this, as not understanding itself, because its whole existence is predicated on continuing wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So, of course, when you understand it that way, it makes sense that the Buddha would give us a way of recognizing our behaviors in thought, word, and deed in a direct and easily understood and applied way, what we just discussed these last 3 weeks, the basic framework of the Eightfold Path. And now, getting to the point of that, concentration, when developed and practiced, leads to developing peace and calm here and now. Two, to developing useful knowledge and true vision. Again, putting things in the context of the Dhamma, what's most important in developing understanding of the Dhamma is to actually develop understanding of the Dhamma. True knowledge and true vision in relation to what we're getting into next week, the three marks of existence. That's the only insight that we're hoping to gain, because it is singularly the most important insight. Insight to the impermanence of all things, insight into the misunderstanding of the impermanence, and from that misunderstanding creating a self that's rooted in those wrong views, anatta, and the resulting dukkha that comes from that. Number three, developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. So true mindfulness and useful mindfulness is knowing what to hold in mind and what to recollect. We can hold in mind anything. And if we're holding in mind things that are outside of the framework of the Eightfold Path as our Dhamma practice, it's not likely we're going to be able to stay focused and develop the Eightfold Path. Number four, developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion, all rooted in concentration. In fact, if it wasn't for a measure of concentration, we wouldn't even notice that our Dhamma practice is bearing some fruit. And again, we talk about that often. We're noticing behavior that we now want to change, or we notice, in sometimes very subtle ways, behavior that we have changed. We're recognizing it. It's so important to do that. How does the Buddha's rhetorical question, how does the development of concentration lead to peace and calm here and now? When properly engaged in shamatha vipassana meditation, one is withdrawn from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana, which is delight and pleasure born of withdrawal and accompanied by focused thought and insight. Again, this is touching. The Buddha taught four levels of meditative absorption, the jhanas, to simply describe in a very general way exactly that, deeper levels of meditative absorption. As our meditation deepens our concentration, it's important to recognize that. This word, the jhana, has been taken to mean to describe a meditation method that doesn't make any sense, for one thing, but is beyond human beings to even do, so why do we do it? The Buddha taught the jhana simply as a benchmark to recognize that our concentration is increasing. And as he describes the different levels, you'll understand that you've developed these levels, even if it's just for a moment. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana, focused thoughts and insight still. Delight and pleasure born of composure and interpose arises. So again, we've all experienced that.
Say that
again. Sure. Probably, hopefully better than the first time I said it. As concentration deepens, as concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana. This is focused thoughts and insights. This is when focused thoughts and insights still. Delight and pleasure born of composure and inner poise arise. So again, this isn't trying to describe a permanent state. Permanent state can't be described. It's not even describing a lengthy state during meditation. It's simply describing a common state that arises during meditation. So I would bet that each and every one of us, at least for a moment, has noticed that they're unattached to their thoughts. They're not attached to feelings that are arising or passing away. They're simply mindful of their breath, and that feels pleasant. Everyone has had that experience, haven't you? Anybody have it? I mean, it's okay if you don't, but the point is that it's a common occurrence, and it's not something that's all that hard to achieve, but it's important to recognize. The Buddha continues, as concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana. The light and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear, describing a well-concentrated mind. And it can easily be said, well, the goal of meditation is so that we're not aware of pleasure or pain or the absence of it. It's not. The Buddha is simply describing that the experience of the third jhana is simply to not have it be a thought. We're not concerned with it. But being unconcerned with it is not a goal. It's a happenstance of a well-focused meditation practice. It occurs naturally. The Buddha continues, as concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. Greed and aversion disappear. This is the development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. And then the Buddha continues how to deepen that, because we got to be done a little relatively earlier, at least on time. I won't get too much further into that. But the Buddha gets into deeper levels of how concentration occurs. But it's simply to understand that as we practice right meditation as the Buddha described, and Shamatha Vipassana meditation is the only meditation the Buddha ever taught, and he taught that, again, consistently in many suttas. The Yoganatha Sutta and the Kamsuka Sutta come to mind, but also when you relate Shamatha Vipassana meditation to the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta, the suttas on the four foundations of mindfulness and the suttas on breath awareness meditation, you'll see that this is all the Buddha ever taught, and the only reason he ever taught it was to maintain or develop and maintain a well-concentrated mind. So we now see the importance of a well-integrated Eightfold Path. As we go around the room, I'd like to hear from you how you are integrating the Eightfold Path into your life, and if you believe that you can develop the Eightfold Path completely in this life. Jen?
Yes.
Yes. Good.
Yes and yes.
Good.
I just got stuck on something that you just said. So I feel like I need to start talking, but I'm not ready to start talking. So sensations arising and passing away within us are always happening, and sometimes it's important. I don't want to say important, but sometimes it's skillful to recognize or notice that sensation, because it might help you navigate your world better.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you notice how a facial expression makes you feel, or you notice a cramp in your leg, and those things might help you maneuver through your life appropriately. And somehow this ego just gets really wound up about how important it is, and how it's just this aspect of your psyche just gets carried away. And this practice helps you overcome that propensity of your mind to just do its own thing. And when you were talking about the jhanas, is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
Jhana? It's like the layers, the deeper you get into your practice, how far along. Like, I still think abstract sequential. I still think in terms of linear, you know, so it still feels, even though it's not a linear thing, it's the first jhana is kind of the first place you get to, and the second jhana is the second place you get to, and the third jhana is the third place you get to. The arising and the passing away of sensations in your body happening all the time, and not putting a story on those sensations, and not judging those sensations, and not attaching a like or dislike or a pain or pleasure to those sensations, is something I've been practicing recently. And it's been helpful because I'm noticing how often I judge something that arises within me as being bad or good. And then that just sends me off into a place of suffering.
Yeah.
And so just kind of noticing something arising and then just saying, okay, you know, that's just what's happening right now. And getting to that place of it's okay because it's just happening. It's what's happening. It's what's happening. It's not something you need to judge. You don't need to do anything about it. It's just been, and that requires us a lot of concentration.
Yeah,
a lot of concentration. Yeah.
And it's the essence of Dhamma practice. Because what you're describing is where the opportunity to awaken lies in this moment.
Right.
But not in a way that we should create an overemphasis on the present moment. It can't be done. But we can continue to incline our minds in the present moment towards awakening, towards understanding really the great mystery you were describing. What is it that's having these things and these feelings and these thoughts and all that?
Right.
Going down that road is just another distraction. What is important is to recognize that that is what's occurring. There are feelings. There are thoughts. There are distractions arising because of feelings and thoughts. That's what we need to gain an understanding of it. And why is it so important? It is the primary aspect of the not-self characteristic of anatta to establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs to it, because that's the only way that it can maintain itself. It's all happening here. And it's all happening on an idea of who and what I think I am. But remember, that idea is rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. This is what the Buddha taught. So anything, any thought, word, or deed that follows from that initial ignorance is going to be rooted in that initial ignorance, isn't it? Which means, what that means is that this not self-characteristic is doing everything it can to maintain its own existence, no matter what follows from that, no matter what disappointment or suffering follows from that. And when I speak of it in that terms, it almost sounds like some real monster, something that's taken over. But the truth of the matter is, when we start understanding that it's just an idea, it's like foam on the ocean and it just falls away. But first, we have to be willing to engage in the struggle that Jen's talking about, to confront this thing that doesn't want to let go. It feels like annihilation. How? And there was even a subtle question, like, how am I going to relate to the world? Don't I need to speak? Don't I need to get out of the way when a bus is coming? Yeah. And you'll be much more effective at that when your mind isn't distracted from maintaining something that can't be maintained. You'll simply be much more mindfully present. You'll make better decisions. You'll get out of the way of the bus much quicker. Thank you. It's so important to bring that up. Anthony, good to see you.
Good morning. So your first question was how you incorporate the Eightfold Path into your life.
Mm-hmm.
I think just generally to listen to myself talk and listen to how my body feels. If somebody does something, you know, and I can feel myself getting welled up, I go, wow, where's that come from? You know? And most of the time it's not from the person. It's just something that maybe I can't even analyze it. But to be able to stop it and not react and recognize that this is just something that's going to pass is very helpful. Yeah. And the same thing with the self-talk. If I'm on the road and there's a lot of traffic, you know, I hear my mind going, yeah, they're all trying to annoy you by going so slow. No, they're not. That's just what I'm telling myself. You know, and it's really true. It's like there's a repetition to these thoughts, that, you know, when certain circumstances hit. Yeah. And so if you could stop that and not react, you could bring a lot of peace there. Like I used to, like you say, I used to be really aggressive on the road. I can remember taking my crook lock and swinging it at people. And, you know, now I just like, all right, you want to follow me closely, we'll do this for a while, and eventually you'll get tired. Or maybe I'll pull over and let you go. And it's so liberating. But I could feel that in me, like that anger coming up.
Yeah.
So if you just let it pass, it'll pass. But if you bite down on it, it's just going to get worse. Yeah. And like in practice, legal practice, you know, I had this thing where I could feel myself getting welled up when the phone rings, and I just go, okay, well, I could sit here and let that ring 3 times, and that's a way to keep control, and then nobody notices, but I can just calm down. I'm not like ready to just jump and grab the phone. Or if a big motion comes in, I'll identify it, and I'm not going to read it, because if it's to dismiss my case or something, it's going to make me really angry, so I save it for when I have time to read it. Like, I can walk past it and let it go. And I don't do attack letters anymore to people. I sit, you know, I'll assert my point, but I won't attack back. And there's a big difference between being nasty to somebody and being assertive about what you believe is the position. Okay. And I think the court likes that better. They like the bigger person. So even though it might feel good in that moment to attack back, you don't really win in the long run.
Yeah.
And I don't send nasty emails. If something is on the border, if somebody's being aggressive with me and I need to put them in their place and it's like 5:30, I'm going to save that, because that email that goes out is 9 times out of 10 not going to be very tactful if it's late and you're tired. So those are some of the ways that I try to bring the Eightfold Path in my life. What was your second question?
That was enough. Do you think it's possible to develop the Eightfold Path fully?
You mean perfectly? No. But most of the time, yeah. I think people slip. I don't know. I have doubts about whether somebody could be truly awakened, because we're human. But I think we can be mostly awakened.
Do you think maybe I shouldn't even get into this, but I am. Do you think the human mind is able to completely comprehend dukkha?
Yes, absolutely.
And do you think a human mind can establish itself in peace and calm?
Most of the time. I think it's too hard. It's just there's too many things out there. You're undoing a lot of baggage.
Thank you for what you described, because you're describing a Dhamma practice that is rooted in restraint and framed by the Eightfold Path. That's how it looks. You know, when it comes up, you apply it. So, thank you. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Good morning, everyone. When I come to class often, this often happens to me when I'm driving home and thinking about what's been said and all the teaching and things like that. I often think, this is the one, this is the teaching, this is it, you know? And it happens every time I come here, and every time I drive, this is it, I've got it now, this is it.
And you've been wrong every time?
And again, I was sitting here, listening to you describe our day, and I said to myself, this is the teaching that I should play every morning, you know, that you're going to have these moments in the day where you revert back to what you do, you know, habitually you have done, and that what Anatar is, you know, trying to conduct you to carry on doing. And that occurred to me, as I say, when you were teaching, that I've had that moment again. This is the one that's going to make the difference, you know. So anyway, and
you'll be right one of these times.
And then I know you always teach just to be gentle with ourselves, and we're on the path, and this is going to take a time to get your head around it. Da, 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 da. Having said all that, I must be some kind of nut, because there are moments in the day where I know that I've had a thought that is what I think and what I do, which is anatta, not a skillful thought, it's an unskillful thought. And I do it anyway. To change your behaviour, to what the Buddha is asking you to do, to change your behaviour away from who you have been and who you think you are and what you think you should do. Oh, it's an exhausting task and it's never ending. And I must admit, I know that, again, we've talked about, you know, Anthony just answered that, you know, can you ever really concentrate your mind enough to know what's going on in your mind? Well, I can't anyway. Anyway, I sort of talked myself into a brick wall, I think, really. But that, you know, just the day-to-day practice of abandoning anatta thoughts, which is what you've spoken about today, is... And it seems to be although that's what the practice is, at the moment, it seems to be unrewarding to abandon a thought which you would like to do to continue anatta and all that. So, you know, so in the that's what probably makes it difficult. Even though that's the overall, to change your behaviour, to change your thinking, that's what you've got to do. In the moment, it seems not satisfactory to take the Buddha's teachings.
So that's
what I've got. Right, well, you can go home.
yeah, it's true. So dukkha occurs.
I know.
You know, even in Dharma practice. So, even to have that realization, you have to understand the nature of anatta, which of course you do, to have that proper perspective, and that is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't understand who we are,
mm-hmm.
and unless we do something to change that, we're not likely to understand who we are. You know, and again, the Buddha found a direct way to overcome all of our deluded thinking that would keep us blocked from that, including the idea that we can't. You know, why? Who am I to say that I? Who am I to doubt someone who said, "If you do this, you'll awaken"? Unless I'm pretty deluded myself, wouldn't I? I mean, I kind of have to be to go up against that. If I really believe that that Siddhartha Gautama awakened and taught and left his teaching, I'd be foolish to say anything against it, wouldn't I? Although people do, or change it in any way.
Just something that Lorna said that kind of like resonated. So we get deeper into this practice, there's sensations that arise, thoughts that arise, and we have the capacity to immediately recognize those thoughts and feelings as anatta, which can create aversion right away.
To not having, not being able to establish yourself in that.
I don't want to be having that thought because that's anatta. I don't want to be having that feeling because it's anatta. And then I start avoiding the feeling of the thought instead of accepting it and recognizing it as anatta in a there's a difference there, and I can't even articulate it.
Well, and this is the obvious need for a well-concentrated mind, so you can get back to this point of recognition and continue to develop the abandonment of those thoughts. And it's done in that instant. Yeah.
That you're already on to abandoning when you haven't even fully recognized.
Yeah, you know, Lorna has put it like describing it as you're missing out on whatever the phenomenon is. You're missing out on the passing away. We're pretty good on the arising, noticing what's coming into our lives, but we don't notice at all. I would say maybe it's 100% what passes away, except when it's dramatic enough to get our attention.
Right.
Which means we're missing. Just on that level, we're missing half of our life experience. Forget about, you know, any type of spiritual idea. If we're only here for the acquisition stage, we're missing an entire part of life because everything is impermanent. And that again, a properly developed meditation practice within the right framework, you can see the instructions. They directly relate to noticing the arising and passing away of phenomena during meditation. So that the training we're giving our minds on our cushion is directly applicable off our cushion. And you see that? Do you see the application of it that way? And the practical application? It has to be that way.
I'm just wondering, in terms of what Jim was saying, passing away, are you saying the passing away is the accepting? No, I'm saying recognizing that it has arisen, staying with it, while it passes away, that's the acceptance. That answers your question, because for me, I notice it arise, and then I immediately, I'm like, that's anatta. No, I'm not accepting that feeling. I'm not accepting that thought. Like, I don't want to be having that, and that creates more tension. Instead of
the acceptance.
Instead of you want to eat more chocolate cake. Okay, well, let's just feel that feeling until you don't want to eat chocolate cake anymore, because you probably won't in like 20 minutes. I mean, that's the practical.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, I leap right over that, and I'm like, I have to eat the cake. And then I'm in the fridge.
And look at how cleverly anatta used the Dhamma against awakening.
Yep. Exactly.
Again, it's the need for a well-concentrated mind and the framework to recognize those wrong thoughts. Mm-hmm. Look at the self. I mean, that's why I said that it's so important to apply right speech to what we're saying to ourselves.
Right.
Because that's really the ongoing problem. Is we're doing everything we can to keep ourselves distracted within a story that we ourselves have established as our life. And we're not willing to give it up.
Isn't it terrible?
It is until you realize that there's really nothing there.
Right.
And aren't we fortunate to have a way of going from that point of view and taking ourselves and our whole life way too seriously to an awakened point of view where we're able to gain such power and meaning in life by taking ourselves much more lightly, much less serious. Because we realize there's nothing that can happen to an impermanent self that's always in a state of becoming. And we could get hit by a bus, but we've been given senses to know when to get out of the way. But we don't have to let those senses define our whole life unless we fall into the belief of we are what we think. You know, it's the biggest myth that was ever put out there. You know, I think, therefore I am. If we don't have the right framework for what we're thinking about who we are, we're going to become what we think we are. There's no other choice in it. But if we have the proper framework to see things clearly, we will, hence the words, become awakened. That's what Buddha means. Buddha means awakened. We can become awakened in this lifetime. I've been saying we got to finish on time, and I keep talking, so we're going to go to Andrew. Anthony, you had a question. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to say, follow up on something Lorna said. She said that it's difficult when you're in that process to, rewiring your circuits, that it can be painful. And I just wanted to add that it can be, but I think it pays a lot of benefits in the long run.
Oh, yeah.
My wife and I were having lunch yesterday. We don't really talk a lot about things, you know, like how things have changed for me. So it was a little like out of left field. But and this is a funny story. About 4 years ago, we were biking in the Keys, and I was training for a triathlon, and I was going, like, really fast, and she couldn't keep up with me. And I wasn't being very considerate, and I was plowing ahead, and then she ended up falling down an embankment. She screamed. That scared me, and I went down an embankment. So anyone looking at that would have seen two people go down an embankment simultaneously for no apparent reason. And I tore my wrist, and I was talking about tearing my wrist, and she said, yeah, you were very considerate back then, but you've changed a lot. And I was like, wow. And it was really nice to hear, because I didn't know I wasn't being considerate.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess you can't operate above your level of consciousness at the time, but I feel like this has definitely changed me.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Again, our behavior, if we're willing to look at it, will show the state of our consciousness. Yeah. Good for you. Andrew, good to see you this morning.
John, you said something in the last couple of sentences, which is the idea of not taking yourself too seriously, and I just smiled to myself, and that is so helpful overall.
Is it?
At any time, and especially during meditation, when all these overly serious thoughts come up, and just, you know, let go and take yourself less seriously. But the issue of concentration is a pertinent one now for me and my family. If we have a parent who's dying, and there are lots of emotional things going on, we simply interfere in a way that other daily occurrences don't. And I've had a really hard time even concentrating properly, reading consistently to do that. But it's just one of those impermanent things that will pass, and my meditation practice will be less turbulent. later on.
Thank you for sharing that, and it's good to recognize that when there's a lot going on that has our attention, you know. But the best thing we can do is to meditate and let that be enough. In other words, if we lose our concentration as soon as we're off our cushion, okay. But at least we've given ourselves that refuge. You know? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Gary, good to see you. How's your practice been going?
Good. I think in reference to the Eightfold, I think for me personally, I'm still learning that. I'm still absorbing that. And that's, I think, where I want to be. I want to be to the absorbing stage and be the sponge stage and take it all in. I think actually the words of last week stayed with me, particularly the comments about little white lies and that sort of thing. And I had those thoughts throughout my week and thought about how many times that kind of came up within me.
Yeah.
And thought, you know, in the past, that was kind of acceptable because it was just a little white lie, but then I realized the bigger picture of that.
Yeah.
And I think in Anthony, is it?
Yes.
Anthony's statements about work-related things. And I think that's a large part of why I wanted to come here, to be able to shed that, but also not only to shed it, but to deal with it, to be able to handle it, and I see a lot of people that don't. But maybe indirectly also to be a model. Where a lot of that angst, anxiety, and that sort of thing, when it comes down to it, in the bigger picture, doesn't really mean anything. What I tell a lot of the people I work with is the sun's still going to come up tomorrow.
Yeah.
We work in a manufacturing environment of a product, and it's world not going to end if we're delayed or something happens with that. So I think in large part that's why I want to be here and try and go the Eightfold Path and learn more and more of it. And also, what the events of this week, I don't want to say trying to digest or make sense of it, but to try and be centered and to try and, in some parts, lead a path that others, that reflects in others, that I don't know if personally any of us can do anything of the events of this week, but in perhaps the people that we touch, that we can exhibit some kind of lifestyle that is somewhat exemplary.
Thank you. Those are pretty important and achievable aspirations. And if we really, there's even a word for it. It's called the bodhisattva, one who has great compassion for other human beings. In order to achieve that fully, the most important thing we can do is awaken and not in any way contribute to the suffering of the world. You know? These seem like extraordinary times, but they're really, these times are very similar to the times of the Buddha. And the solution then, I think, is just as applicable, is develop awakening and at least remove your contributory factor to suffering. And then we can be a true example, like the Buddha was to others. And you know that there's this series of talks has been recorded. You can catch up if you want.
I presume that, yeah.
Okay, good. I'm glad you're here today. Jay, good to see you this morning. How are you?
It's good to see you, too. I'm doing okay. I'm fine in the calm and peaceful department.
Yeah, good for you.
I'm having real problems here, but again, I'm retired. I don't have stress from work and whatnot. And that's all good during the day. Apparently, at night, I'm up to all kinds of mischief in my dreams. I'm flailing around and yelling at people, so I don't know how one affects that. But, maybe when I'm the calm and peace during the day, is my mind deluding myself to what it really wants to do, which is get into some kind of conflict, So I don't know quite how to deal with that, but the thing I am working on is the identity business, because, for so many years, I identify myself as a father, I identify myself as a crane operator, and it takes less effort to be a parent at this point, and I certainly don't have to worry about running the crane at this point, and I'm getting okay with the idea that my identity is not this one thing sitting there, and whatever it wants to be, the hell with it. It's okay with me. Not getting as hung up on, trying to stay as I, and whatever it turns out I am, it's okay with me. I'm pretty loose about that. So that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, thank you. Good for you. Because that's what we are. In the moment, this is what I am. And at times you'll be a dad. At times you'll be a husband. At times, if you're talking to an old friend, you might be back in the saddle again. That's just what's occurring. Thank you, Lisa. Good to see you this morning.
Good to see you too, John. Great to be here and hear what everybody has to say. So I always have so many thoughts going off in all kinds of different directions, and I guess I often use the analogy of life as a web and thoughts as a web, but and this isn't, a lot in the book will say, and well, we already talked about this earlier, but it'll be good to go over it again. I think I read that in this section, and that or we'll talk about this more later, or that'll be addressed in whatever. So it's not linear. It's just this whole.
Yep.
And it's infinitely interrelated. And I also think that, like what they said, doctors practice medicine, and nothing is perfect in this world. Is anything perfect in this world? Or are we always just approaching but not quite getting there? I don't know anything about physics and this, like the universe and science and things like that, where you can just always approach something but never quite get there. And so this occurred to me. Do you feel that in your own life, that you can always improve, like you're never quite there, like you have lapses, and you're a human being, so we're all
do I have lapses? Yes. What is most profoundly different for me now than it was, let's say, 20 years ago is there's no fear. When 20 years ago, that was my inner motivating force, even though I didn't realize it. My Well, that's enough. I mean, what I can tell you is that the Eightfold Path is a path of wisdom, increasing virtue, and increasing concentration. And I can tell you that that's true. I mean, it just is. And more so from my own experience, although that's important, from so many other people that have integrated this into their lives and made profound changes. Whether they're awakened yet or not really isn't important. What is most important is maintaining the Eightfold Path. So. And I think that's what you were saying, so thank you. Diane, good to see you.
Thank you for being there. Thank you for doing this steadfastly. I think the only... one of the things I came across this week was annihilation. Thinking, okay, I don't have an eye. Oh, what am I? And I thought for a moment, that's kind of boring. And then I thought, but that's really okay. I felt comfortable with that. That it like takes a lot of pressure off of having to be something. I don't know whether that's very profound, but I'm okay with it.
I agree. When you don't have to be nothing.
Well,
sounds like you're not taking yourself too seriously.
There are a lot of things going on in my mind and in my life, and it's a way of avoiding them. I don't know, but I can't make any decisions. I'm not making any decisions about anything, and I'm okay with that. And I'm just taking a day at a time.
Yeah, sometimes no decision is a decision. You know, when you don't have enough info at hand, you can't make it yet. So you wait. It's best to wait with a peaceful and calm mind, because then when it's time to act, we'll likely know how to act. And if we don't, it's okay. But again, as we integrate the Eightfold Path, that can guide us. Antony was really describing that so well. You're practicing restraint even at the level of writing a letter. That's true restraint. You know, and that's why the Eightfold Path is there. To understand how to act. And there's so much power and freedom by just checking in. You know, I know I'm acting within the framework. I'm good to go. Thank you, Diane. Debbie, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thanks, everyone. So I was just, the one thing that hit me in that chapter was kind of what you were just talking about, was the peace on the board I'm in. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you let go of all the sensory stuff, there's a sense sometimes of boredom. And I was thinking, that's so true for me. I have a kind of mind that wants to be busy all the time, you know? And it also relates to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the conditioned thinking, because I'm taking myself too seriously. Mm-hmm. And that busyness in my mind is a lot of times self-destructive. So, thinking I can't do this, or caught up in stuff that's not helpful. So I think I need to start choosing the boredom. But, you know, trying to let go of the thinking and the sensory input, and just trying to just be with. Okay, it's okay if I'm, like you were saying, it's okay. I'm just bored right now, accepting that and seeing it as something different that maybe reframing it.
That seeing it in reality, meaning as this is what's occurring, and it's only a mind that needs stimulation or different stimulation than it's getting, that has the experience of being bored. I need something else to get my attention now.
Right.
I can't be my breath; it's not working. It's got to be something else. It's got to be a chocolate cake. It's got to be a new Ferrari. It's got to be breaking par. It's got to be getting a tweet. Is that correct? Anything that will distract me. And I need it now! Mm-hmm. Or I can just come back to my breath. But that's a difficult thing, though, isn't it, Debbie?
Yeah.
It's getting right down to it.
Yeah.
And so we do the best we can. We be very gentle with ourselves, or we'll never get past that. And we remember that meditation is for deepening concentration. And every single time that I recognize that I'm distracted by my thoughts and my feelings and come back to the sensation of breathing, I'm deepening concentration. I'm doing exactly what an awakened human being taught to do. Come back to my breathing.
Well, and also, it's just so much about acceptance for me.
Yes.
Because that conditioned thinking is, I have an aversion to, you know, the meditation. I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I can't do it, you know? And so, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but just trying to let go of that conditioned thinking.
Yeah. It's so prevalent. That thought, you know, I don't know if I've ever talked to a meditator that didn't describe that feeling, that I just can't do it. You know, and of course, think about that from just a rational, logical point of view. We're asking a human being to sit down quietly for 5 minutes and do nothing. And so many of us can't do it, or we think we can't do it anyway. But
thinking
you can't. Of course you can. Of course, any human being in reasonable health could sit quietly for 20 hours, that really shouldn't be a problem, should it? Besides, you know, the normal things that a human body has to do. Why would that be a problem? Because our minds have a constant need for distraction. How is it not a problem? When we develop concentration, a well-concentrated mind.
And your body fights you, too.
Well, yeah, with
it's
sensation.
Like when I sit down, sometimes I could feel my body, you know, an itch develop somewhere or a twitch.
Yep.
And I was like, you know, and you realize there's a pattern to that. It's not happening when I'm not meditating.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, it's often just another useful way to continue to distract the mind with physical sensations. So. Yeah,
and it's conditioning, mind-body conditioning.
It is. And you're describing that beautifully, Debbie. In fact, you described that a conditioned mind very clearly nearly every week. You have a great recognition of where this is going. And it's going to a calm and peaceful mind. But a mind that does not want to be calm and peaceful, at calm, at peace, calm and peaceful, is going to struggle with anything that addresses that. That seems like it's taking away from its own control over thoughts, words, and deeds. What a foolish thing to do, to sit quietly and be mindful of your breath. Who'd want to do that? What value is it in there?
Well, there's also something in our culture, especially in the addiction culture, that
yes.
says, keep busy, keep busy,
yeah.
keep busy. Boredom's not good, boredom's not good. You know? So,
yeah.
I mean, there's that, too. You know, that,
yeah,
you
the
know?
new, it's not that new, but the new model for especially early recovery is keep yourself busy.
Yeah.
I had a guy that came to me when I was 18 or 19. He said his recovery theory was go grab a shovel and dig holes in your backyard. For one thing, I was living in my dad's house and he had a nice yard, so that wasn't going to work. But we, you know, we're at least getting more realistic with things like that have a strong component to how you think. And if you're not going to change how you think, you're not likely going to change your behavior. That's rooted in realistic recovery. But that understanding is rooted in a basic understanding of ignorance. It's the reason we act the way we act in certain ways and in certain situations because we don't understand the nature of the reality. The next few weeks, and it might be 3 or 4 weeks, we're going to really get into the nature of impermanence, the not-self characteristic, the resulting suffering, and what this vehicle looks like, and how can we really gain control of this thing that's me. And of course we can. But one of the things we have to overcome, like what Debbie's talking about right there, is that need to judge ourselves, even as we're moving towards awakening, towards a more holistic state. We'll still judge ourselves harshly, won't we? Sometimes it's just the realization that we have to change, or we should change, that we beat ourselves up with. And isn't that foolish? But that's a conditioned response, where it's kind of taught that the way to improve ourselves in any situation is to find out what you're doing wrong, where you're falling short, beat yourself up for 2 weeks or 20 years, and then you'll change. Of course that's not going to happen. It never has. We've developed a society of self-loathing people because they feel like they've underachieved somewhere, rather than recognizing that none of those things are based on models that are based on assumptions, mental fabrications. The only thing we should do with them is recognize them and abandon them and think clearly. Because then we'll stop that those self-sabotaging thoughts that we're always putting in our mind. I don't want to get on a soapbox today. But this is what this leads to. The Buddha's Dhamma, by directly addressing the result of our poor thinking, meaning through the Eightfold Path, through recognizing our behavior, and using that to change our behavior, is brilliant. And it was never tried before. Up until that time, we always tried to add something to it or create some type of spiritual diversion. In other words, we're not praying correctly. We're not praying enough. Or we didn't sacrifice was big during the Buddha's time, too. We didn't sacrifice the right animals. That's why things are happening. Rather than things are happening because I'm living in the world and I don't like it because of the way I'm thinking. Because if I change the way I'm thinking, what occurs would not be a problem. We'd simply recognize it as this is what's occurring. This is my life. Tom, good to see you this morning. We got to get going.
So, yeah, I identify a lot with the busy mind. It's always, you know, at work all day, I'm troubleshooting things, and then I come home, and it's my brain still troubleshooting and trying to, you know, find problems even when there's not problems, and yeah. It's really just an anxiety thing. And I think, for me, I think that the more, I guess, the first arrow stuff that I deal with, that really kind of puts me into this mode of busy mind, and then telling myself that, well, you can't just sit here and do nothing, because you got to do something to, you know, fix all these, you know, imaginary problems that I'm coming up with in my head, I guess.
Yep.
And it's amazing how, you know, when the first hour distractions get me in that conditioned thinking, that it, like, opens the door for, I guess, the I-making and ego self and all of that to come in and destroy my meditation practice and keep me from coming here. And, you know, I also noticed a pattern of myself and family members who, when we get, you know, stressed and have all this anxiety, we tend to retreat into isolation. And, you know, every time I come here, I feel safe and feel, you know, calm and feel refreshed and all that. And it's amazing how I stop coming when the stress comes.
Yeah.
And, you know, retreat into that isolation. I also, you know, I think Anthony was talking about, you know, the kind of the itch and everything else. You know, the last couple times I've come here, and as soon as you stop talking and we started the meditation, my throat gets so scratchy. I'm trying not to cough, and then, like, all of a sudden I'm fidgety. It's like my whole body is rejecting me trying to meditate.
But you made it.
But I made it. And it took a good 10 minutes before.
Yeah, but you made it. That's the important thing. The strategies we'll come up with to avoid awakening are...
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And I think of it from this seat, seeing all these strategies, and they all seem reasonable, why I shouldn't meditate, why I shouldn't practice.
Yeah.
And we discussed that the past week, too. Part of right effort is recognizing the hindrance to awaken. And what do? Sit down and meditate. Develop the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. Come to class when we feel like we really don't want to or need to. Because it works, because it delivers. And it's a good question to ask yourself. How come I don't want to do this? You know, why? Because I don't want to let go of these views of self. Okay, well, great talk. We're going to read the next chapter on the three marks of existence, and then the week after that is dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates. So we may spend more than a couple weeks on these next two chapters because there's a lot there. And I'll have a different reading in the email. March the 4th is our painting day at Raritan Learning Cooperative. So if you can join us, I hope you can. I think that's a Sunday at 1 o'clock. I'll have some info in Monday's email, too, about that. But it's just a painting party to support the Mary Beth's school down there. Our retreat's coming up. If you haven't signed up, please do so as soon as you can. That's May 17th to May the 20th. And Gary, could I have a moment of your time after class? Thank you. All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living things. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.